Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. The Roman Catholic Church plays a significant role on the world stage as well as in countless individual lives. So when there's a problem within the church, the effect is made worse. Our guests Jason Berry and Gerald Renner report that currently there is a serious problem within the Roman Catholic Church. It goes well beyond headlines about sexual abuses. In fact, they say there are a number of problems that prompted them to write Vows of Silence, the abuse of power in the papacy of John Paul II. First, Jason Berry.
The terrible bind that the church is in is that it cannot attract large numbers of stable heterosexual men. And that is the challenge in this country. And in all of these Western countries, how do we get heterosexual men back in the priesthood?
Gerald Renner?
The other untold story of the Catholic priesthood is how many are attracted to women, perhaps other men. We have 4% that have been identified as pedophiles. There needs to be a much, much, much greater look at the sexual mores within the Catholic Church.
Gerald Renner and Jason Berry are both seasoned reporters and are both practicing Roman Catholics. Each had done long years of research independently before joining forces to write Vows of Silence. Mr. Renner is recently retired from the Hartford Courant, where he was a staff writer specializing in religious news issues and trends. Mr. Berry is also author of Lead Us Not Into Temptation, and he is widely published. Bill Russell and I find abuses of power unacceptable in any venue, so when Jason Berry and Gerald Renner were in Atlanta meeting with faithful Catholics who share their concerns, Bill and I welcomed Mr. Renner and Mr. Berry to our studio and home. Jason Berry and Gerald Renner, I like simple phrases. I think sometimes simple phrases have some truth in them, but you have turned one on its head for me. One that I like is silence is golden, because there's so little silence in the modern times. And yet you say silence has its dark side, that silence has real problems. Both are true, are they not? And where do we begin to think about the dark side of silence? Jason Berry?
Well, I think for the two of us, as investigative journalists and as Catholics who have written extensively about the problems in the Catholic Church, the idea that silence can be imposed to block the light of the truth is sort of a fueling reality for us. And both of us have been dealing with this subject in different ways for a great many years. I published a book in 1992 called Lead Us Not Into Temptation that was the first major look at the child sexual abuse crisis in the church. And the new book that Jerry Renner and I have done together, Vows of Silence, is subtitled The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. And with all due respect to the Pope, God bless him, nevertheless, as we have explored in this book, his detachment from the crisis that arose well before the events in Boston of 2002. In fact, in Australia, Canada, and Ireland particularly, the pattern of sexual behavior within the clerical environment was so pronounced that legal action and media coverage began to be quite common in the early 1990s. All of that led us to decide to track the lines of authority back to the Vatican itself in what we've written.
Gerald Renner?
And in our book, we go to the door of the Vatican. Most of the other cases that we've heard about here in the United States have involved American priests. Here we cite a case study where 9 men, 7 Mexicans and 2 Spaniards, had been abused when they were young boys in the seminary, brought into the Order of the Legion of Christ when they were as young as 10 years old and started being abused when they were 12. And they've come forward and they've tried everything to call this to the attention of the Pope, even filing a case under canon law in the Vatican in 1998, which was accepted as worthy of investigation, but went nowhere after about a year or so. And the Vatican is somewhere, perhaps where the American bishops were 30 or 40 years ago. They have no policy. In the United States, a priest who had 9 accusers would have been bounced long ago. The Vatican has no such policy.
And in jail, presumably.
Well, perhaps, yeah. After a, the problem is these abuses happened in Spain and in Italy, in Rome, the legal systems are entirely different.
One of the challenges for those of us who didn't grow up in the Catholic tradition is to understand the structure, the flow of power, the flow of influence. Who's in charge? Who's not in charge? Who thinks they're in charge? And it would help, I think,
when we come back,
because it turns out that even the things I thought I knew turn out either to be just dead wrong or seriously misguided. So I think it might help those of us who
indeed. When we come back with Gerald Renner and Jason Berry, who are the authors of Vows of Silence: The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. This is The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I invite you to be with us when we return. This is The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to have Gerald Renner and Jason Berry with us. The topic is somewhat more troubling. The topic that you address in your book, Vows of Silence, is a troublesome one. It is about power. It is about sexual abuse. It is about trouble in a very big institution in the world. And I think Bill's right. I think some of us would be well served to hear from you. How does this work, Catholic Church?
And you say somewhere in there that it's the last functioning monarchy, which puts things in an unusual perspective.
Well, I think in the United States, we certainly have the presumptions of democracy always with us. And we know, for example, that if a local judge is on the take, if the system works as it should, the district attorney or the U.S. attorney will go in and indict the guy, and then the system will do its work, removing a judge who was in a position of authority. In the Vatican, when a bishop becomes a cardinal, he takes what is called a pontifical vow, a vow to the sovereign pontiff of the church, in which he pledges not to allow scandalous information to come public, to make sure that the church is protected from attacks, if you will, based on scandal.
This is part of his vows as a cardinal?
Yes, yes. And one has to understand this historically. There are many instances in church history of church leaders or ordinary priests being wrongfully attacked because of hatred toward Catholicism. I mean, in Birmingham, Alabama, in the 1920s, there was a beloved pastor who was shot dead on the front steps of the parish by a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I can remember as
anti-Catholic, not anti-black in that instance.
Absolutely. I can remember as recently as 1985 watching Jimmy Swaggart on television railing against the Catholic Church. Certainly he had his own demons, we now know. But I think it is this culture of secrecy that so permeates the governing layers of the Catholic hierarchy that has been hand in glove, if you will, part of the problem, part of the crisis in the church. And that's what we tried to explore in this book, the way in which the logic of secrecy works in preventing information from getting out, and more so, what that mentality of concealment does to men of the cloth who are presumed to speak the gospel, to speak the word, to speak the truth.
So
I read that vow, and it struck me, particularly in the context of your book, as being problematical. But it's also easy to look at it historically and say, well, you can read it as if the responsibility is to prevent any actions that would tend to make that happen.
To make a scandal happen?
To allow a scandal to occur, which gets into the dangers that come when people are both making the rules and interpreting the rules and enforcing the rules. And it seems to me that, and this goes, I'm still interested in how the hierarchy works, to the institutional correctives for abuse. Do they exist? Do they exist effectively?
Gerald Renner?
I think one of the mystique of secrecy has come out of the medieval ages and permeates the Catholic Church. I was a spokesman for the U.S. Catholic bishops for 2 years in 65 to 67, but learned pretty quickly that as a layman, I wasn't being included in what's happening. Half the bishops felt my job was to keep stuff out of the public, and the other half to place favorable stories. And I became...
And how did you see it?
Well, it was just this whole secrecy business, mm-hmm. and I went on into other journalism afterwards. I knew nothing at the time about the sexual abuse, but that's what happened when the bishops would start transferring a priest from parish to parish. And it was this whole veil of secrecy that surrounded this that wasn't uncovered until journalists such as Jason Berry got onto it in Louisiana and others eventually around the country, culminating in the Boston Globe's expose in 2002. What they showed, what the Boston Globe showed, they got through a courageous judge, they were able to get the documents behind these cases. And I think Catholics were just shocked at the cavalier way bishops treated the victims. And they were very solicitous of the abusers. They didn't lift a finger to find other victims. But that could only happen because of the secrecy.
And secrecy twice over. Yes, Bill, we'll talk about the hierarchy. And you used a phrase that I'd not seen before, that the police in, I don't know, I think it was Chicago, called it tight collar crime, that it was also the whole system worked against the victim, against what is known in other parts of the world as transparency.
Well, that's quite correct, Paula, but let's also be fair in the way we apportion out criticism. As recently as 20 years ago, there were very few cases of prosecutors indicting pedophiles. It was the taboo that people did not speak about. The abuse of children was something that society barely recognized. One would know certainly that it was a crime, and yet it took a great deal of head-turning in the media and in the legal system before people began to be prosecuted. So, yes, the police did take men when they were caught, priests that is, and turn them back to the bishop. Those were tight-collar cases. And in many large cities, especially where you had an Irish or Italian Catholic power structure, judges, cops, lawyers, state representatives, that was just the way it was done.
You refer several times in this context to the common law traditions in the English, particularly in the English-speaking countries. And it seems that that common law tradition has certain implications, particularly in those countries, but also the conflict or the discontinuity between that and the Italian and the church tradition is genuinely confusing to the hierarchy, to the Vatican, to the cardinals, and ultimately to the Pope.
That's very true. Most of the cases that sort of exploded into the public consciousness beginning in the early 1990s, there were some here in the United States, but as an international phenomenon encompassing Ireland, Great Britain, Canada, and certainly Australia, there was a wave of these cases in the 1990s because these countries sharing a base in common law give attorneys the right to what is called legal discovery, meaning you can send a subpoena to the person or institution you're suing and you can get documents from them.
And they have to give it to you.
And they have to give it to you. And if it's found that they are destroying documents, they can be prosecuted for destruction of evidence. In contrast, the Italian legal system is very different. It is built on the notion that a magistrate, a functioning judge, questions people in the courtroom and sort of guides the way in which a civil case or a criminal case unfolds. And that's not to be cynical about it. I'm simply stating it as a fact. I'm not an attorney myself, but I interviewed attorneys during the time when I was in Italy doing research, as did Jerry when he was there. And what we found were only 19 priests in all of Italy who had been accused of abusing children sexually.
And that was a period of over, what, 10, 12 years?
Well, actually, yeah, closer to 15, I think, or 20. But what is so
is that they weren't accused or they weren't doing it?
Well, no, these were different cases. Some were prosecuted, some were accused. Mm-hmm. But these were men who were prominently identified through the legal system and thus in the newspapers. I mean, most of these sources we got were from newspaper articles. And with assistance from a very capable young man who did a web search in Italy on our behalf. And when the Vatican does not see an issue in the Italian media, it looks to the United States and these other countries with an air of detachment.
For a long time, this was called an American problem. And then when it started popping up in the other English-speaking countries, it was called an Anglo-Saxon problem. And yet it's a universal problem. This is a frailty that's found in all nations and nationalities.
I found myself reading this and thinking of, you mentioned medieval, of that time when the church was a parallel temporal power. Mm-hmm. And the impression is that in the minds, at least, of some of the people, and particularly the conservatives, and that's a big issue in what you talk about, that mindset, that view of who has the authority is still very much intact.
Yeah.
Jason?
Well, I think there is a certain temperament, an orthodox temperament, which is not to say all orthodox believers feel this way, that we support the power structure. I suppose hierarchy would be the word that an orthodox believer would say. I'm using a journalistic term. We support the power structure because it is the Catholic Church and it is the oldest church in Christendom. And one could cite other reasons for that. I, as a Catholic, as a discerning critical thinker, certainly want my bishop to be someone that I revere and respect. But if he is not living up to the job, I think we have a responsibility to speak out and ask questions. And I think all too many of the defenders, for example, of Father Maciel, the head of the Legion of Christ, are people who want the church to be the way it was, say, in the 1950s, when there was this unanimity about being Catholic. We live in a much more fluid age, and I think we all have to be honest in acknowledging what has happened.
This is Jason Berry. Gerald Renner, would you let me invite you to begin the next segment when we return in just a moment? This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'll keep this quick. We'll be back in a moment. Please be with us. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell, of course, is here. We are with Gerald Renner and Jason Berry, who together have written a book called Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. Jerry Renner, I interrupted you. Please continue.
I was just going to point out that there's no corrective balances in the Catholic Church. Cardinal Law of Boston was finally forced to resign, not by the Vatican, but by his constituents. They were so shocked, and particularly when 58 courageous priests of the archdiocese signed a statement saying they lost confidence in the cardinal. But there are other bishops out there who, if they had any integrity, would resign as well. I think the basic problem going back to the Middle Ages is the church is built on this medieval structure, and a bishop has one constituent, and that's the Pope.
That's a problem.
That's a problem. There's no other corrective balance, except in this country. There is the media, and there's the lawyers. They finally forced this into the open.
Which, in a way, really makes the leadership role of the hierarchy in America quite unusual, doesn't it?
Well, that's true, Paula. I think what the church desperately needs is some form of separation of powers. I would never want to see the Catholic Church become a pure democracy.
I don't think there's much threat of that, is there?
Not only is there not much threat of it, I use the term pure with a certain edge of irony in my voice, but thank you. In a democracy, the court system stands separate from the legislative branch and the executive branch. The code of canon law, which is the church's legal system, is such that the Pope, whoever is Pope, can intervene in any legal proceeding at any time and halt it, which means that justice is sort of, in an ultimate sense, in one man's hands, and that's not healthy. That's not to say that...
Whoever the person might be.
Well, exactly. And, you know, in the case of Father Maciel, the head of the Legion of Christ, he is in Rome with standing accusations by nine men from their seminary years. The religious order that he founded, the Legion of Christ, is starting schools and has started schools in the United States and other countries. Came out of Mexico in the 1940s. Children who go to the Legion schools are taught essentially to venerate Father Maciel. They are taught that he is a living saint. I would dispute that heatedly. I think any man who is accused of pedophilia so widely as Maciel should certainly not be held up to this kind of high respect. And yet people have children in schools, and I don't think really understand the history behind this man and his movement. If there were a separation of powers in the church, if there were an independent mechanism, and we're starting to see the beginnings of this with these lay review boards in different dioceses, then there would be a way to force the resignation of a bishop if his governance was so out of line. There would be a way, for example, with this kind of mechanism to go into places where a group like the Legion is functioning and at least force them into some sort of public dialogue.
I found as I read Vows of Silence, and this is always kind of a good mark for me, it made me really uncomfortable lots of times in lots of ways as I was learning things. And I went in thinking, well, I know something about the Catholic Church, and well, yeah, I follow headlines. But you were really in a serious way looking at all kinds of challenges within the church with this particular focus on child abuse, both male and female children. Didn't that wear on the two of you?
I think so. I mean, I've been a journalist, you know, for all my life. And but I'm not a Catholic, brought up a Catholic, went through 16 years of Catholic schools. But as a journalist, I looked at it as a journalist. And it certainly affected my family and my children I had in Catholic schools and so forth. But there was no hesitancy about reporting this, as a journalist should. It just came naturally. I never.
Well, it does make it quite a stronger case that you are on the inside.
Yeah.
But it also, I would think, would leave you prey to people saying you're airing dirty laundry. We've seen the headlines. We don't want to hear this. The church is just fine.
Well, yeah, that's a common attitude.
Yeah, but I think especially since the media coverage of 2002 and the Boston Globe reporting that ignited a kind of chain reaction, that people don't tend to view journalists as, you know, the messenger who should be attacked because of the message. That was certainly the case, I should say, in Louisiana in the mid-'80s when I began this reporting and wrote my first book on this topic. But I think what is more important, and I think the rank-and-file members of the Catholic Church feel this way, is that the truth come out, is that we understand what is going on inside the church so that we can change it.
You quote, I think it was a canon lawyer, attorney, representing this group of men. I think I've got this right. And at some point she said, better that these eight men should be wronged than that thousands of people should lose their faith. And that seems to be at the core of, you know, and that's one of the major issues.
That's right.
Isn't that troubling?
That has to be dealt with.
And was she not speaking for the church in saying that?
I believe so. That was a very loyal canon lawyer, a woman
who was in Rome,
who had to be approved by the Vatican before she could handle a case like this.
But she was effectively speaking to her clients, wasn't she?
That's right. She was the one who was steering the canon.
She was the one that represented them.
Yeah, and it was further undergirded by a Mexican bishop who was in Rome and asked Cardinal Ratzinger, the top theologian in the Catholic Church, a very powerful man. And Cardinal Ratzinger reportedly told him that Father Maciel has brought many, many good men into the priesthood, as if this were a reward. We won't look at the charges of pedophilia because other people will lose their faith.
Again, this was very troubling. This father, this cardinal, who is the chief theologian for the Catholic Church, Ratzinger, do I pronounce
that's
it right?
Yes.
Well, the Inquisition.
He's the head of what used to be the Inquisition.
That's right.
That stopped me cold.
I thought we quit doing that, and we changed the name.
And this function continues within the Church in what seems to me an incredibly anachronistic function, and yet nobody's shy about saying that's what it is. They changed the name over the door. It's the same.
The history.
It's still going on. But those who are suffering are these, in this case, the innocents who are being abused. What's wrong with this picture that the Inquisition is still alive and well?
Well, I think, in fairness to the Church, as shocking as these things are, and certainly, I mean, I would be less than honest if I didn't say that after the shock, as a writer, I thought, this is incredible. This material was so rich. The layers of secrecy were just oozing with contradictions, and the coating of ironies that we found and so slowly peeled away, almost as you would, the layers of an onion. It's the most amazing story I've ever covered as a writer, as a journalist. But all that said, I think we find the psychodynamics of secrecy in many power structures. If you look at what is going on in the Bush administration right now, with this constant pressure being put on them about the rationale behind the invasion of Iraq, were there weapons of mass destruction? Well, you know, even Hans Blix, the man who was in charge of the nuclear, the inspections of those sites, is now coming out with a book saying that they didn't level with us. And I'm not just singling out the Bush administration. You could look at Nixon and Watergate. You could certainly look at the French Revolution. There are many examples historically.
Well, and it's not just in politics. You can find it in any place there is power. You can find it in corporations. The abuse of power is
sure.
a lot of what you're talking
about.
And organized sports, to say the least. Yeah.
So the subject really in this case is power, and it happens that you have dug deep into the Catholic Church in looking at ways that that power can be abused.
Yes. Lord Acton said famously, power corrupts absolute. Power corrupts absolutely, and let us remember he was a Catholic.
And he was speaking of the Pope.
Yes.
And the drive to make the Pope infallible in 1870.
In 1870, yet again.
One of those many things
Vatican
that I learned.
Vatican I. Yes, yeah. Vatican I. And I guess I knew that somewhere, but to remember that the Pope only started being infallible when there was a vote after everybody else went home.
And a very divided vote.
Very divided.
Yeah, but I think the theologians will argue that he's always been infallible. It was just a matter of defining it.
Well, all the same.
Infallibly.
There's a circularity to that.
I think so.
But some of this is interesting to me as one thinks about things that we just take for granted. And if we don't go back and look at the context, the history, the where did this come from, papal infallibility goes all the way back to 1870, which was Vatican I.
Yes.
When
mm.
then you reminded me that Vatican II, with Pope John the 23rd, who's had to get in line to be a saint because there were politics going on, as you report, that these things are all, I mean, that's within living memory, and still we've forgotten some of that. Well, I've talked too much. Let us go to a break. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell's here looking at me saying, stop that, Paula! We are delighted to have Gerald Renner and Jason Berry with
whom
us.
Whom we will let talk.
We will
soon.
In a moment when we return. Please be with us. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are honored to have Jason Berry and Gerald Renner, the co-authors of Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. When we went away and I was talking too much, the subject was Pope John the 23rd, who in 1963, called together Vatican II, 1961?
First sessions, yeah.
The impact of that, it wasn't just the 60s, and it was the 60s. The impact of Vatican II is still very much present as you talk about many of the things happening in the Church in 2004, is it not, Gerald Renner?
Absolutely. The Second Vatican Council, among many reforms, suggests that it was the time for the laity to become more involved in the Church. They defined the Church as the people of God. They defined the Church as more on a horizontal level, as against the hierarchical picture that everybody has. The Holy Spirit talks to the Pope talks to the bishops talk to the priests talk to the people. Vatican II turned that around and said, no, we all have a responsibility for evangelism and for being part of the church. That's still being fought out, you know, 40-some years later. And I think one of the great bright spots in the whole sex abuse scandal are the numbers of Catholic reform groups that have been growing up, the Voice of the Faithful and others, the Survivors Networks and others who want a role in the decision-making of the Catholic Church. You know, ironically, the bishops are scared to death of that.
Well, and it seems that both the laity and many of the priests are now willing, still very much in the shadow of the Second Vatican Council, to say, yes, and I want to be heard on this. Your Father Doyle is one of those.
Well, Tom Doyle is really the hero of this book. He is a Dominican priest who entered the seminary in the early 1960s. In fact, his education as a young Dominican occurred as the Second Vatican Council was, in essence, the great pageant of Catholicism in the early 1960s, the idea that a church nearly 2,000 years old could undergo a period of 3 or 4 years of deep introspection. And what came out of those years was a sensibility of profound reform, the idea of lay people defined as people of God, capital P, capital G, people of God. And the mass changing from Latin to the vernacular languages, English, of course, in the case of the United States, and the many hopes and aspirations that priests and nuns had for a great step forward for the church, as Pope John the 23rd himself said, aggiornamento, the lifting of the windows to let in the modern world, the winds of change. Doesn't mean throwing out the baby with the bathwater, as we say in the South, but nonetheless, what happened under the papacy of John Paul II, and we say this with great respect for him, but nonetheless, he has been utterly reactionary to letting the church move forward in a way that allows freedom of conscience to truly become a baseline in the way the church functions. And the most glaring example of that is the rigid autocratic way he would not allow bishops in this country to oust pedophile priests. And, you know, when I was in Rome during my leg of the research, I was stunned to interview a canon lawyer. We refer to him as Father X in the book because he wanted to keep his job. But he said in the interview that as far back as 1989, when the American bishops requested the power under canon law, a change in canon law, so they could kick out child molesters, the Vatican said no, because the United States tribunal courts within the church were much too permissive, much too liberal in granting marriage annulments to divorced Catholics, to Catholics who had divorced and wanted to remarry within the church. Well, what? And I stood there in this Roman afternoon with milky sunlight coming through the window of this ancient building, and I was sort of, you know, my mouth agape, and I said, well, you know, what do marriage annulments have to do with pedophilia? And he said, well, if you don't respect the laws on one, you won't respect the laws on the other. On the other, I think it's kind of a disconnect. Didn't add up to me.
Sex is in both.
Well, yes, sex is in both, but I think the real problem is sexual segregation. This is a power structure of unmarried men who have not walked the rug at 3 a.m. holding that baby at the shoulder who has colic, as Jerry Renner has done, as I have done, as so many other people have done. I'm not saying I should be a priest or bishop, but I think if married men were allowed to become ministers in the Catholic Church, it would go a long way toward rejuvenating the priesthood. Whether that will happen, we don't know, but I think this Pope has certainly been anything but sympathetic to the need for structural reform.
On the subject of governance and the hierarchy and how this operates, I found myself thinking of Father Doyle and in most other power structures, particularly an absolute monarchy, he wouldn't have survived. And yet he was able to remain a priest, to remain in more or less good standing in the church.
Left one part of the church to be in another, but wasn't thrown out.
But it's still a functioning member of the community and of the priesthood.
He's still a recognized priest, but he had to get out from under the immediate hierarchy when he joined the Air Force. And that gave him the freedom to testify on behalf of many, many plaintiffs, and he was an expert witness against the church. Which made him a pariah, in the eyes of the hierarchy.
I think also it's important to underscore here that Tom Doyle was the canon lawyer in the Vatican Embassy in the early 1980s. He saw the problem in the United States before anyone else did, really. He co-authored a pioneering report, almost 100 pages, warning the American bishops and the Vatican, if you don't forge a policy to get rid of these kinds of men, it is going to be a disaster. He was prophetic in that way, and they fired him. And so he joined the Air Force, got into a different sort of line of command, but remained a priest and has done amazing damage to the church by testifying against his former colleagues in the hierarchy.
And time and again stands with the survivors saying, I am so sorry for what the church has done.
You said damage to the church. I don't think you mean that.
I mean damage to the political sensibility of the hierarchy, the idea that we are above the law.
And the question is, what is the church? And I found myself reading this, trying to figure out, and this goes back to Vatican II and the whole history of the church, going back almost 2,000 years.
And Jesus saying, where two of us are gathered, there am I, I remember.
And it seems to be a core question. Who or what is the church?
One of the basic problems historically has been the further centralization of the Catholic Church. The first 1,000 years was nothing in the governance like it is now. And this pope and recent popes have assumed more and more authority and power over what happens in the church. And I think that's a bad thing. There needs to be further decentralization.
At the risk of using a fully loaded word, it's almost as if this pope, John Paul II, has instituted a counter-reformation in response to Vatican II.
I think so. I think what's happening basically, a lot of the fault lines in the Catholic Church today have happened as the losers of the Second Vatican Council have regained more and more power and are reversing what the Council did.
It's interesting that the term many of these Orthodox intellectuals use is Catholic Restoration. And of course, what they're about is the restoration of constituted authority that Vatican II, in many minds, began to undercut. Look, every institution, every society needs solid authority, but it must be just authority.
You also are really gracious in saying of Pope John Paul II that he came out of a particular time standing up to a communist challenge and working his way through and has become known as a champion of human rights. And yet, for all that you are very nice about that, and yet there's this blind spot that has to do with the authority of the Pope, and he are it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that myopia sort of calls to mind the hubris of kings and Shakespearean tragedy, that there is a blind spot. And in his worldview, I believe, or if you will, from his prison, celibacy is
prison?
His prism, the way he sees the world. I think it's fair to say that that Pope John Paul sees celibacy as a kind of, in an almost romantic way, as a form of chivalry, of great sacrifice. And certainly many, many priests may conceive of it that way. But at the same time, he has been utterly unable to look at the sexual behavior patterns within clerical life that have rocked the church almost to its foundations.
This gentlemen, before we continue, let me go quickly to a break. All three of you want to speak. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Jason Berry, Gerald Renner, Bill Russell. We'll all talk at once when we come back in a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are pleased to have Gerald Renner and Jason Berry with us. And Bill has his hand up. We're talking about the subject he has in they have in a book called Vows of Silence, The Abuse of Power in the Papacy of John Paul II. Bill Russell?
We've had the luxury of reading this book and talking a little bit with these gentlemen. Not everybody has. It would help me to get a sense of the Catholic Church in the world. You focus principally on people who have done really hideous things, and other people who have responded appropriately. But it's hard
and
to
some
tell.
Responded you know, inappropriately.
What percentage of priests are pedophiles? Is it in fact an Anglo-Saxon problem, or is it a problem around the world? You talk about the sheer quantity of priests leaving the priesthood, the fact that they're not coming in, which makes anybody that can recruit them a more powerful force. I know that my recollection is that in the West, the developed world, numbers are dropping, participation is dropping. In the developing world, it's exploding, both in the Catholic Church, but also in evangelical churches. So could y'all do a quick overview of the status of the Church?
Jason,
25 words.
Yeah, well, you've raised several questions. First of all, the data on child molesters in the Catholic Church is only really available in the United States because of the exhaustive study that, to their credit, the American bishops funded, which found that almost 4,400 men had done this within the priesthood over the last 50 years. That's about 4%, which I think is high. Although we don't really have an adequate baseline of data in the general population to figure out whether that's higher or lower. So, you know, the people who crunch numbers can debate that. The state of the church in other parts of the world is very different. As you said, there is an enormous growth of not just the Catholic Church, but evangelical Christianity in the Southern Hemisphere, Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, which leads many Vaticanistas, the people in the press corps in Rome, to speculate that the next pope may well be Latin American, which would not surprise me were that to happen. I think the two great issues that occupy the Vatican when you can actually get people to sort of let down their hair, as it were, is they're very concerned about Islam and the relationship of Christianity to Islam, which is indeed an overarching issue for all of us in Western society. And there is also the concern of evangelical Christianity, Protestant sects and churches siphoning off not just Catholics in these countries, but middle-class, educated Catholics.
With money.
With money, exactly. Now, in the United States and Great Britain and Germany, which are the three national churches that provide the bulk of the Vatican's budget, there is a very restive lay population that wants greater answers, greater accountability. So, in a sense, the Church of Rome is on a ledge, you might say, between two dramatically different societies. The highly educated technological societies of the West that have embraced the digital revolution, and the often deeply impoverished emergent societies of the South, Latin America and Africa. How these two will finally mesh remains to be seen, but changing the celibacy law would redound to the benefit of the church in Latin America as in Africa. There have been enough reports about the sexual abuse of nuns by priests in Africa, and certainly abuse cases involving priests, in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa with the nuns, and then in Latin America with the abuse cases involving priests, so that I think the church could be rejuvenated if we had a visionary pope, a pope whose vision was fixed on how to rejuvenate the church from within, as John the 23rd did.
I think in Latin America too, there's a tradition in some countries of the village priests having a family. Often before they appoint bishops, they have to vet these guys to make sure they don't have a dozen kids somewhere before they make them a bishop.
And you do say that this could happen with the stroke of a pen.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Celibacy is a law. It could be changed. It's not dogma. It's not, saying that we have a God composed of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That is something that is at the core of Catholicism, and we're certainly not suggesting that that be changed. But celibacy is something quite different.
And relatively new.
Well,
only 1,000 years old.
Yeah, since the Middle Ages.
And the Eastern Catholic churches today, the ones who recognize the Pope, they have optional celibacy, as does the Eastern Orthodox churches.
You know, harking back to the comments that we exchanged about Pope John the 23rd, I think there's another dimension of his papacy that is going to loom in years to come, and that is the brilliant way that he stood in the eye of the media. This was a man who understood the news media. He understood symbolism. And as the paradox and contradictions of the church's rigid sexual stance and the behavior patterns within clerical life continue like tectonic plates to sort of rub and chafe against one another, I think it is inevitable that a pope will come along and realize we have to be more honest and truthful about ourselves as members of an ecclesiastical power structure and community. And when that pope comes along, when those changes happen, I, for one, would hope to see a renaissance of Catholicism.
There needs to be a conversation about the changes made, and Pope John Paul II has absolutely forbid conversations about ending celibacy, admitting women priests, and other things in a very
birth control, for instance.
This is
pelvic issues generally. Yeah.
The pelvic issues. Yes.
As we're often told, God
is rock and roll.
As we're often told, God is in the details. You know, everything comes down to context. The context here, though, historically, is really rather fascinating. A pope who was a great progressive. In the realm of human rights, who stood like a valiant figure against the darkness of the communist empire, at the same time has been so unable to look within the church itself. And so one would hope that down the road, as historians begin to... some of them, I'm sure, will attack us for what we've written, saying that we, you know, maybe overstated the case. I'm quite comfortable standing on what we've written, and I think this book will be remembered for years to come as a breakthrough in the way people look at papal history. All that said, I think as the historical appreciation of John Paul grows, both the better and lesser parts of his legacy, I think we'll see a certain pressure against the Vatican to come into the light of the world that people actually live in.
It would seem that part of the challenge with your optimistic vision is the...
Oh, I don't think I'm optimistic. I'm just not hopeful. I'm just not a man who lives with doom.
But the Pope chooses cardinals, and there are a lot of cardinals. Mm-hmm. This is a very, very, very long-serving pope over a long history, mm-hmm. and he's had the opportunity to install people, many of whom, most of whom, seem to share his... counter-reformatory perspectives, and it would seem that the next pope is going to come out of that group of people and is going to be selected by that group of people, and the kinds of changes you outlined would on average be a long time coming.
And yet you also say that Pope John the 23rd was just supposed to be a caretaker, that he kind of was a surprise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and this pope is one of the longest, the third longest living pontiff in history at this point. And despite the fact that he appointed mostly all of the cardinals, I think there might be five there that he did not appoint that would be eligible to vote for the successor to John Paul. It's unpredictable. They're not all cloned, and we just don't know what the next guy is going to look like or do. They'll probably try and go after a caretaker again, but they might be scared looking back at what happened to John the 23rd.
John Barry? Jason Barry, excuse me.
Yeah, I'd just like to say this. I'm not sure that who the next pope is nearly as important as what happens among lay people within the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Because in the Western English-speaking countries, one of two things will happen within the next 10 years. There will either be a great loss of numbers of Catholics simply drifting away and going to other churches or no longer going to the Catholic Church, I think probably joining Protestant churches, or this fascinating drama of tension between lay people and their cardinals. Look, in this country alone, Cardinal Roger Mahony of Los Angeles met with the review board, Robert Bennett, the attorney who chaired this review board, to write this report telling them about the causes of the problem. He had seven lawyers and two PR flacks with him when he met with these people. Now, here is the Cardinal of Los Angeles, who, as we speak, has turned over 200-plus personnel files of Catholic priests to the Los Angeles Prosecutor's Office, to a standing grand jury. And there is an enormous legal battle going on with the church claiming that under separation of church and state, it should not divulge these files. There are so many landmines like that out there across the landscape that the news media will be covering, that the pressure on cardinals and bishops in this country will continue.
And I might point out that for the first time in history, the church attendance among Catholics is below that of Protestants, the first time ever. And it used to be rather dramatic. 75% of Catholics would be at weekly Mass, and Protestants would be around 40% or something. Now it's reversed.
More to be said in a moment. Gerald Renner, Jason Berry, Bill Russell, and I invite you to be with us when we return for a few more minutes of The Paula Gordon Show. A couple more minutes here on The Paula Gordon Show with Jason Berry and Gerald Renner, who have written Vows of Silence. The one thing we've not talked about that you talk about at some length is with the great exodus, 100,000 people, you say, 100,000 priests left the church soon after the Vatican II event. There is at least the accusation that the church became a gay culture. Now, it isn't fair to me, at least, to say gay leads to pedophilia, and you don't say that either. So
no,
speak to that whole issue around the changing psychosexual, I think is the word you use, dynamic within the church.
Well, it's clear that there's been a huge attrition rate of heterosexual men leaving the priesthood to get married, a corresponding escalation in the number of priests who are homosexual. I think there have always been priests who were homosexual. Whether they acted sexually is something that we don't have as much documentation on, although in the last two decades, there's been a great deal of literature, a lot of it sort of, you know, confessional statements and things like that. I'm using the term ironically. There's a big gay priest culture, and we draw a distinction between priests who happen to be gay and lead the celibate life and those for whom the identity of gay priest supersedes Catholic priest. And that's problematic, which I say as a liberal on most issues other than abortion. The terrible bind that the church is in is that it cannot attract large numbers of stable heterosexual men. And that is the challenge in this country and in all of these Western countries. How do we get heterosexual men back in the priesthood? Yes, there have been promiscuous gay men. There have been patterns of narcissism and materialism. Doesn't mean all priests who are homosexual are bad. The sad reality is that the vast majority of these abuse cases involve teenage boys. So there are obviously a lot of regressive, immature men who have acted out with kids.
Gerald Renner?
The other untold story of the Catholic priesthood is how many are attracted to women. And perhaps other men. We have 4% that have been identified as pedophiles. There needs to be a much, much, much greater look at the sexual mores within the Catholic Church. One of the outstanding things about the bishops, they did this study courageously, and it's the only institution in America where these kinds of statistics have come forth. Ireland, as a nation, did the study looking at teachers and sports figures and the others. So there was a comparison. We need that kind of a comparison here.
You've done a great deal of work. There's more to be said, and we're out of time. So we will thank you, Gerald Renner and Jason Berry, for the work you've done and for taking it out to the rest of us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Been a pleasure to be with you.
We thank Jason Berry and Gerald Renner for bringing to light problems that affect us all, and we trust with them that they are now part of the solution. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.